Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Layla Gentle. I'm chair of the President's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women. We are a group of 36 women that represents the diversity of UCOP, and we've been bringing this series to UCOP since 2009. So today, we have a fabulous speaker, Monica O'Connor, chair of the Board of the UC Region. And she will be interviewed by Karen Petrolakis, who is UCOP's Chief Deputy General Counsel and Deputy General Counsel of Litigation. Did I get that right?
You did.
This will be an interview, and we'll be some time at the end for questions. So I will turn it over to Karen to introduce our wonderful speaker today.
Thank you.
Right. Well, I have the pleasure of introducing Monica Lozano, the current chair of the Board of Regents, and I know you all want to hear from her and not from me, so I'll make this pretty brief by way of a little bit about her background to give her an introduction. She's currently serving her second 12-year term on the Board of Regents. She served on the board from 2001 through 2013 and was reappointed by Governor Brown in 2014. She is one of the most respected Hispanic business leaders in America, with a long record of accomplishments leading large media organizations that serve the Latino communities in the United States. She began her career in 1985 with the country's leading Spanish language daily newspaper, La Opinión. I hope I pronounced that right.
Yes, perfect.
And worked her way up to publisher in 2004. And from 2010 to 2014, she served as the chief executive officer of Impremedia, which is the parent company, and a well-established leader in the coverage of issues important to the Latino community, and is recognized by civic, business, and media organizations for its journalistic excellence and award-winning editorial content. And during her tenure, she transformed the company from a newspaper business into a multimedia, multi-platform content company. And most recently, she was chair of the board of directors of U.S. Hispanic Media, Inc., which acquired Impremedia, and she just stepped down from that role in 2016. She also served as a member of President Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, as well as the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board. She is currently a member of the boards of directors of Target, Bank of America, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Weingart Foundation.
Correct.
And other boards in the past as well. And in addition to her tremendous support of the University of California, she has devoted much of her professional career to other public service and nonprofit organizations, including the National Council of La Raza, where she served as board chair. So we're so pleased to have you here at UCOP and here to talk with us today a little about your career and life.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I know you can't probably all see me, and I don't know if I should stand, but thank you for spending your lunch hour with me. Nothing like having lunch with the head of litigation. So I'm prepared. All right, let's go.
Not as bad as the legislature.
I'll find out.
Well, just to start out, I mean, you've had a highly successful career in publishing and media, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you started out your career and how you started down that path.
Sure. Thank you for that. So you heard really at a very high level sort of the steps of my career in media, but the origination really was 90 years ago, not because I'm 90 years old, but because my grandfather crossed over from Mexico and started a daily newspaper called La Opinión in Los Angeles in 1926. It's three generations of Osanos that ran the newspaper. My grandfather's generation, really as the founding generation, very committed to the issues of representing the then Mexican community in the United States. When he passed away, my dad ran it for about 35 years and went through that transition, as many of you remember, during the 1960s, when there was much more of an awareness of civil rights and the sorts of issues representing different communities. So he transitioned it, he says, from a Mexican newspaper to an American newspaper that happened to be published in Spanish. My brother and I joined, my brother joined earlier than I did, but I joined in 1985. And it was the transition to the third generation. My brother was being named publisher. I had been living up in the Bay Area, actually, and decided that there was tremendous opportunity that I was just beginning to realize by having a daily newspaper in Spanish that reached the growing Hispanic community. And I joined in 1985. And I'd say the difference, and the reason why actually I was the last Lozano to end up being a part of the company, we can get to that later, is because I made a deliberate choice to be there. There was a real expectation that the other my brother and my sister were expected to work there. I chose to work there. And when you make a deliberate choice in life, and you think about all of the reasons why you choose a certain path and the kind of impact that you hope to have, you know, it sets you on a trajectory that is very deliberate and very intentional. And you're sort of thinking every single day about what is it that I want to do to make sure that I'm giving this institution the very best of myself. And so I joined in 1985. I spent 10 years on the content side, and then you heard I moved through the business side, ended up becoming the chief executive officer. I'll just close that story right now by saying that when Impermedia was acquired by U.S. Hispanic Media, Inc., they bought 100% of the company. And so it was probably one of the most difficult decisions I had to make, which was actually to turn over something that had been a family legacy for going on 100 years and to now deposit that in the hands of somebody else and hope that they have the same commitment and the same vision and the same sort of you know, focus about why we exist and what we want to accomplish. And so anyway, I say that those chapters of my life are over, but the novel is still not finished. And so I'm in the process of rewriting, not rewriting, but writing a new ending to what I hope is still a very fruitful and very productive set of years ahead of me.
Who would you identify as being most influential on your career?
That's a good question. And I don't know if it's influential. Certainly my father. You know, there's always like one person who's sort of your touchstone, right? And so as I was going through very difficult decisions about, you know, anything, it could have been something related to work, it could have been something related to my personal life or making choices about how you spend your time and on what you spend your time. I would turn to my father, clearly, because he just has such good judgment. But I also have a very strong group of girlfriends. And I really believe, especially for women that are professionals, that are making, you know, career choices, it's important to have peers that you really trust and that, you know, sort of innately understand what you're going through and help you navigate through that decision-making process. So I have a group of six female friends, and all of them very, you know, well-regarded professional women. And in Spanish, there's a word called comadres, where you're like what is a comadre? When you baptize your child and a godmother. Thank you, your godmother. You would know, Diane, your godmother. But it's much more of a sort of a, you know, a deeper relationship than just the, you know, godparent and godchild. They really become, you know, your best friends. And so I turn to these women all the time. And then there is one other person, because it's relevant to this group. There was a man that I served on a nonprofit board with that identified something in me, saw real potential. And we were just like board members together on the YMCA board. And he was the president of a local bank, a regional bank. And, you know, over time, he said, you know, I've watched you work. I really believe in, you know, how you approach things, your work ethic, your judgment, blah, blah, blah. And he asked me to go onto his bank board. And that opened up a series of, you know, possibilities that I never would have dreamed. You know, you don't wake up one day and go, oh, I'm going to serve on an advisory board for the President of the United States. You know, that just doesn't happen, right? It's a series of things. Life is a zigzag. One of the first zigs in my life was when that friend
invited me to go onto his board, and that started a series of networking and careers, and over time he's become both a sponsor and a mentor and a very close friend. So it's important to have girlfriends, it's important to have somebody who's your sponsor, and then the person who I call my touchstone, which is my dad, who just helps you really sort of evaluate decisions because they know you so well that they can help you really just sort of navigate that.
The Greek community has the same relationship. It's called Kubari, and it's a sort of the same thing. Reflecting on your leadership roles that you've served in throughout your life, what would you say are the qualities that maybe that person saw in you, or what are the qualities that have best served you in those roles or enabled you to serve in those roles?
I'm a pain in the you-know-what. I'm really driven. Some people might call it ambition. I'm not really sure if that's what it is. But once you're in a role, you want to do your very best. And if you say yes to something, then do it all the way. And so, you know, the bar is set really high. I set my own bar very high, is what I want to say. I expect a lot of people, but I'm not going to ask them to do something I wouldn't be willing to do myself. I'm a continuous learner, and I think it's absolutely essential, especially in today's environment, to always be thinking about how do you bring innovation into an organization, how do you look around the corner, what is it not that's in front of you today, but what could possibly be tomorrow. And so driving that kind of curiosity in an organization is really important. You know, being a strategic thinker, but also understanding the operational requirements of an institution. And that's why I think sort of my path was just perfect, because not always can you find, like I became chief operating officer. I was a COO before I became CEO. And when you're the COO, you're in the weeds. You're operating at a detail level, and you got to make sure that you've got accountability systems and the metrics and you're measuring and, you know. And the CEO is very different. It's about, you know, setting vision and strategy and motivating people to want to accomplish more every single day and helping them, you know, ensuring that they've got the skills. So I'm very team-oriented. I love, you know, walking the floors. I love engaging with people. I think you need to demonstrate in your own sort of personality the kind of passion that you have for the organization and its potential. It's really important to identify, not identify, but, you know, have fun while you're at it. You know, bring some joy into the workplace and find ways in which you can celebrate as a team. So I don't know if I'm answering your question or just rambling, but I have, you know, I think in many ways the kinds of leadership qualities are precisely the ones that you want to see in the people that you work with every single day. And it doesn't matter if you're the CEO or you're sitting across a cubicle from somebody. You know, it's those sorts of qualities in individuals that make organizations. I've always said, you know, companies are nothing more than the people that work there. And if you can understand that and you invest in talent, and you build, you know, the ability for people to bring their entire self to work every day, you know, the organization is going to thrive. And, you know, I used to say it's not about printing a newspaper or putting out a product or a service. It's about, you know, engaging with the people that you work with every single day and finding ways to motivate them, to inspire them, to give them a sense of purpose, to find passion in your work. I'm very passionate about what I've done. I love it. The fact that you can have a company that is for profit, you know, that is a business that every day, you know, you're like calculating how many impressions and who's watching and how much revenue, but you're doing it for the benefit of a community. At the end of the day, there's a social mission, very much like the University of California. This is a public trust. There's a mission orientation to what you do that is just extraordinary. So you want people that are passionate and believe in that mission and aren't just thinking about, you know, what is the task I have to do, but what is the whole of, you know, the sum of its parts and what that means for California and for the state, and well, that is the state, but for the nation. So anyway, those are the leadership qualities I think I have, and certainly what I try to bring to the work environment that I'm a part of.
Great. Well, maybe could you talk with us a little bit more about that mission of the media companies and what type of impact you feel you were able to have on the Latino community through the media organizations that you led?
Sure. So this is Spanish language media, and if you're familiar with it, any of you, there has always, I think since, you know, day one, been an orientation towards service, recognizing that we interface every day with a community that is very aspirational, that in many ways is the demographic that will be sort of the workforce of tomorrow and the contributors to society in so many ways. And our audience was primarily an immigrant audience, like 98% of the people that we reached. And we reached over 25 million people across all of Infomedia. We had a total reach of 25 million. La Opinión by itself on a daily basis reached 500,000 people, half a million, 530,000. Half a million people every single day. And over the course of a week, we were touching 1.2 million lives. And then when we did the roll-up and we had, you know, newspapers in New York and Chicago and Texas, et cetera, the entire audience reach was 25 million. And, you know, if these are people that were born in another country that came, you know, seeking a better life, wanting to contribute, having to navigate a system that they might not be familiar with, and in many ways, for the most part, you know, this isn't what used to be called circularity, where people would come and they would stay a few years and then they'd go back and they would come. Well, that was over for lots of different reasons. And so from like the 1980s, it became much more of a permanent population. And so kids were born here. And parents need to figure out, how do I get them into the right school? And I'd really like to start my own business and work for myself. And how do I do that? And so what it turned out is that our company, rather than just being a source of news, was a source of information that was very empowering. And so we had as a mission to inform, but also to educate and empower. And if we could close what I used to call the information gap, if somebody wanted to buy a house and just couldn't figure out, you know, how do I apply for a mortgage? What is it that I need to do? Given that home ownership is the number one factor in wealth creation within families. So these are just like, you know, a lot of how-tos. I want to become a citizen. What do I need to do? What about the test? What kinds of questions? So we became just completely oriented towards what today they might call public service journalism. But it was really about giving people information that was empowering, became a tool, helped them navigate. And when you do that, you know, I always say you put your customer at the center of what you do. It can't be about the revenue. It can't be about marketing. It's got to be about who am I serving? And if I understand what they need and I can contribute a little bit to that, then there's a relationship. And that relationship carries forward. I mean, there are people that told me, you know, we've had La Opinión in our family for three generations. You know, little kids, oh, my gosh, my dad used to send me to go buy La Opinión every single day. So you're part of a family in a way. And that's a trust. That's almost like sacred trust that you're obligated to understand and to live. And so, you know, I spent a lot of my time being externally focused as much as I was internally focused because I wanted people to know that our responsibility, I mean, I'm assuming you're going to be able to do your job well and you're going to do it on time and you're going to do it with high quality, that our responsibility was as much towards the people that we served. And I used to say this all the time, we are in the service business. And it's precisely because, you know, if we can help provide something that will be useful to you, so we're not in a production, we're not selling newspapers. Our mission is to be of service to a community. And that was the way I approached my work and very proud of what we've been able to accomplish.
That's wonderful. Certainly a lot of public service there, but how did you get interested in other ways that you could serve the public. And I'm sure there's many demands on your time, and how do you focus and prioritize on particular efforts?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because, you know, I mean, even being a regent, it's like, how do you end up being a regent for the University of California? And as we were doing all of this work, I was getting involved in nonprofit organizations and doing stuff at the local level, and I was working with some local school reform initiatives in Los Angeles. And back then, like in the 1980s, 90s, the Hispanic dropout rate was, you know, 60-70%. In other words, graduation rates just out of high school was like, you know, 30-40%. And I decided to do a lot of volunteer work with some local school organizations, school reform organizations. And curiously, I was at like a conference on closing the achievement gap, and Governor Davis was giving like the opening remarks or something. And the woman who was running the nonprofit organization that I was volunteering with, I guess, knows him quite well, and she went up to him and she's like whispers in his ear, and the next thing I get a phone call. I'd never met Governor Davis. I hadn't contributed to Governor Davis. I'm not sure we endorsed Governor Davis, but anyway, I get a phone call, and, you know, can I come up to Sacramento and meet with him? And he asks me if I would be interested in going on the California State Board of Education, which does K-12. And if you remember, when Governor Davis first came in, he had this huge accountability program. It was, you know, teachers and the AP, whatever, the Academic Performance Index, all this stuff. And I called my girlfriend, and I'm like, you know, I'm a mom. I'm a working mom. I've got two kids. They're not 10, either of them, yet. And, you know, they meet, like, every month. And anyway, one in particular said, you know, you're doing all of this great work locally, but you have an opportunity to influence the system at the highest level. And don't turn your back on that opportunity, because it doesn't happen often that people like us get invited to sit at that table. And so I said yes. By my second year, I was chairing the State Board of Ed. Blood for punishment. And then I rotated off, because I told the governor, you know, I love this work, but I've got kids. And I remember thinking to myself, here I am, like, saving the children of California, and I don't even see my own. And it just didn't feel right. It didn't feel right. And then he called back a few years later and said, what about the UC? And at that point, you know, again, I called my girlfriend anyway, and I was like, of course. The University of California, my God, it's the crown jewel. It's worldwide. I mean, it's just, you know, of course you say yes to that. And so I did 12 years with the University Board of Regents. And then again, you know, I got the phone call after I rotated off, and it was Governor Brown this time. And he had some vacancies, and he's probably sorry he reappointed me, but anyway, so I think I'm about 4 years or 3 years into my second go-around, and the board was generous enough to make me chair 2 years ago. So we have a meeting tomorrow, and yes, you all know about that. And on Thursday, they will elect a new board chair. So I've done it for 2 years. It's been extraordinary. And let me just take this opportunity to thank everybody in the room. I am in awe of what you do every single day. I mean, this is a really complicated place. It's, you know, fascinating. It's extraordinary. The impact and the potential are, you know, just hard to even sort of capture. And that doesn't happen, as I said, without, you know, the people that do it every day. So thank you all.
Thank you. You know, one thing you touched on was that you were a mom with two kids while you were doing all of these things. And I think many of us in the room sort of struggle with that, what they call work-life balance, which I always think is more of a seesaw.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever really achieved it myself. I'm always doing better in one part of my life or the other part of my life. And I don't know if you can talk with us a little bit more about how you integrated your personal life and your work life throughout your career and how you managed that.
You know, I get asked that question. I'm sure a lot of women who are professionals and somewhat successful, and I'm sure you guys all get asked about, you know, like, how do you balance? And, you know, I guess the most recent answer is you don't, right? You just don't, because that's just what you do, right? And so sometimes something suffers more than others. You know, I've got a very strong support system, as I mentioned. My partner, we've been together 25 years. He's extraordinarily supportive of me. And I will say it's not always easy to find a partner that can lift women as they become perhaps more accomplished than they are and don't have issues about your own success and why are you going to that meeting and do you really have to go to that dinner and, you know, it's to have somebody say, and David will say, if you really want me to go, I'll go. And I understand the code now. You know? He doesn't have to feel compelled to go to everything because I'm compelled to do it, right? You know, so find what's important to you, and you find what's important in your own life, you know. So just, I think balance actually in a partnership is recognizing that, you know, we're not always driven by the same thing. And we don't have to compete, but we certainly need to be there to support when it's really important. And David will be there to support me when it's really important. And so I think that's, yep, there's no balance. And, you know, you have to be motivated by what is important to you, right? So I actually enjoyed networking. I enjoyed going out and meeting people and talking about my business and getting them all excited and speaking at conferences. And because the business, you know, is being supported by a lot. In fact, it's the only way, you know, you are the best ambassador for your organization. And so I understood when I said yes to becoming CEO that's what was required of me. You know, my kids are healthy and they love me. Mother's Day, they brought me flowers. So I can they're still okay in their eyes. So, you know, it all worked out. And the great, you know, it's silly because I'm kind of, I don't want to say I'm young, but I'm youngish. And to have accomplished all of this at this stage of my career, and now I get a chance to really think about what does that next stage look like? And, you know, where do you want to put your emphasis and your time and your resources and whatever assets you may have built up? And I'm not sure I want to work as hard anymore. And whatever I choose to do, I want it to be personally satisfying. You know, before when you're running an organization, you're making decisions about what's important for the institution. At this stage, I really want to think about what's important for me and for my family. And so I'll probably be making different choices at this stage.
Mm-hmm. Have you, as you reflect back on your career, can you identify any challenges or maybe opportunities that you faced because you're a woman or a woman of color?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Either, you know.
You know, I was very often the first. I'm still the first. It's sometimes really remarkable. And, you know, whether it's just sort of institutional laziness that, you know, organizations don't evolve as quickly as they should, or it's, you know, unconscious bias, or it's just the networks aren't there. But, you know, to this day, you know, I continue to be sometimes, you know, the first Latina, the first woman. I went on to a board of a foundation in Los Angeles that I love, absolutely love. It's called the Weingart Foundation, and we do really important work supporting nonprofits in L.A., And I went on that board about 9 years ago, and it's over 60 years old. And I was the first woman on that board just 9 years ago. And, you know, oh, and I'll tell you this story. I probably shouldn't repeat it anyway. but like a year into it. So anyway, I went on. I thought it was fantastic. We give money away. It's a foundation. And, you know, it was a very small board made up of people who knew the founder. And so they were generationally of a different sort of their perspective was different. But anyway, so I'm the first woman, certainly the first Latina. But the chair asked me to go to lunch with him about a year into it. And I'm like, oh, that's nice. You know, let's go and talk about how things are going. And he says, you know, I need to let you know in private that we don't like your body language. And I know, that's why I'm like, my body language. And I'm like, you know, you may not like my choices, my decision-making skills, but really, my body language. And, you know, part of this is just introducing something that's different into a room and not being able to read those signals. And so they were taking it as, you know, I know you're looking at me like, what?
I'm wondering what
that I didn't know what it meant either. But, you know, whether it's I look pensive or maybe I was scowly, who knows what I was doing. But, you know, it's just like help. So I take those challenges as, you know, learning opportunities where if you've said yes to something, your obligation is to make it better, right? Not to scowl, not to, you know, turn your back on it. You know, it's to figure out how do I actually introduce positive change and find solutions. So, you know, after that, we really went about diversifying the board. It's like, I can't be the only one. So we by then had an enlightened chair. We started to really think very strategically about who are the kinds of people and what perspective could they bring. And so, you know, there have been times when I wake up and I've gone home crying, you know, because it's just an assault at times. And I never would show the weakness publicly, I'll tell you that. I'm pretty stoic. I'm a hard driver. And, you know, but it does take its toll. You know, there's no doubt about it. So yeah, it's hard. There are moments that are very challenging. I mean, this is a challenging moment, guys. but anyway, you know, you do the best you can. And again, I'll say it one more time. Think about what's best for the institution. We're institution builders. That's, you know, the day you decided to work for the University of California, you made a commitment to be part of building this institution. And that's how I felt about the Weingart Foundation or any of the other boards that I'm on. Be constructive, find solutions, you know, be quick to identify problems. But what we should be about every day is about, you know, looking for solutions and being innovative. I'm a huge fan of entrepreneurial thinking, introducing innovation, get some change agents into the room. You know, it's, you know, disruption is good sometimes because it forces you to take a step back and go, wow, you know what? You know, maybe there is a better way to do it. And, you know, always look for opportunity and use it to grow personally as well. It's important.
I know that diversity has always been important to you in your service as a regent and diversity within the university and really kind of growing the next generation of diverse leaders in the state. And I'm just wondering other ways in which you've tried to impact other people and develop other people in your career, either in the university or other parts of your career.
I'll always say one thing. Just about the university, I love our student regents. Our student regents are awesome. They have, like, owned some of the most important work. They have inspired us in some of the, you know, best ways. I remember one of our student regents really, you know, sort of started talking about sustainability and green years ago. You know, issues around tolerance on our campuses, again, introduced by our student regents. There was a young woman, a Latina, who she happened to serve right at the 10-year mark for after Prop 209 and began a whole initiative around campus climate and, you know, what was happening. So I reference students in regard to diversity because we've actually, I think, been really deliberate about making sure that, you know, we do bring representation, not just from different campuses or disciplines, but, you know, points of view. And students are bold, and they will challenge you. And so, you know, I do think I've mentored along the way many of the student regents, and I still stay in touch with a lot of them. And, you know, certainly, like, the official work that we do around diversity, I can't say I'm the only champion. In fact, I'm not. We had Fred Ruiz. We had Eddie Island. There were a number of people that, you know, every meeting would bring up that diversity question. And it's good. You know, it's almost like what we were talking about with boards. You know, someone's got to ask those questions. And so I think we've made some progress. There's a lot more to be done. There's no doubt. It's a complex system. But, yeah.
You currently serve on a number of other boards, and you've in the past served on the board, I think, of Disney and USC and others. And how has that other board experience sort of influenced you as a regent or given you thoughts on how we can do things better on our board or, you know, enabled your service as a regent?
That's a good question. I was thinking about my board service the other day. I was telling somebody this story, so if you don't mind, I'll just... So after the 2008 election, when President Obama was elected, and it was this wave of hope, and it was just like, you know, everybody's like this, you know. Anyway, then the financial crisis happened, and it was, you know, some pretty tough times for everybody, including for me and my company. But I remember being in the office, and my assistant, you know, she rings me and says, you know, there's a Paul Volcker on the line for you. And I'm like, Paul Volcker? And I pick up the phone, and he says, you know, Ms. LaSalle, Paul Volcker. Paul Volcker was the head of the Federal Reserve. I mean, everybody in this room is like nodding, okay, you know who he is. Anyway, so he says, you know, the president has asked me to call you, President Obama has asked me to call you, because he's putting together a small cabinet, a group of people that he would like to advise him on the economic recovery of the country. And I so, you know, I'm really honored, but I'm not an economist, and I don't think I'm an expert in this, and I'm not really sure that I can contribute. And he says, I'm not sure either. Wants you to serve. And it was just a great, you know, and I'm like, okay. So I said yes. And then all of a sudden, you find yourself going through the gates into the White House, and you're one of 11 people, and you're meeting directly with the president on a quarterly basis in his office. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what am I doing here? And you're like, I mean, you know, of course you're going to question your capacity to be an advisor to the President of the United States. And what I realized along the way is, you know, one, you just got to, like, find that confidence. But two, you got to find your voice. Because, no, I'm not Paul Volcker, and I'm not an economist, and I'm not going to bring the same thing that, you know, the dean of the Harvard Business School is going to bring. But there's a reason why he invited you to be at that table. And it's got to do with your perspective. And so don't be afraid to use your voice. And it took me a long time to get over being afraid to find my voice. And I realized that by being on boards, you're not there to be an observer. You're there to contribute. And, you know, I'm not a banker, but I serve on the board of a bank. And I'm not, you know, Bob Iger, but I served on a board with Disney. And there's a reason for your perspective. And so don't second guess it. They didn't. They invited you to join. And so if you say yes, you know, find the courage to speak up. And that's what I think is what I've learned. And, you know, it's certainly, like, in the Board of Regents, very diverse points of view. And I think, you know, when you can find common ground, which is about, you know, strengthening the institution and doing what's right for our students, our faculty, for our staff, for the people of California, you know, you just stay focused on what really matters.
Well, I want to be sure to allow some time here at the end so that people can ask questions.
Okay.
<I'm> ready.
I can't find my voice. I'm ready. Are there any questions? About anything. I'll take questions about anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you can repeat the question.
Okay.
So what you just described was basically a message to, you know, stand out. Have there ever been situations where you found it more strategically influential to fit in? And how did you make that decision? How do you weigh that? And good luck, Karen, repeating that question.
Well, I think the question is that she was talking about finding ways to stand out. And the question is, are there other circumstances where it's more influential to fit in?
Yeah, I really like that question. Because I said earlier when I was talking about my leadership style that I'm all about team building. And I think it's really important to be collaborative and to not, so I don't know if it's fit in, but, you know, certainly my management style, like I set clear expectations. You know, people sort of know what I would expect from them if they're going to be working for me. But then in terms of, you know, then you delegate and you allow people to, you know, have authority and exercise that authority, right? So long as the expectations are really clear. And I really thrive in a team environment. In fact, that's the one thing I miss most. I'm sorry I'm not answering your question, but that's the one thing I miss about having shifted out of a work environment is, you know, I have a home office. I work from home. I look at the wall, I pick up the phone. You know, the intellectual stimulation of being with people and creating together, that is what I miss the most because I just love working with people and being inspired by them and, you know, having just this sense of community. And so I don't know if it's about fitting in, but recognizing that, you know, an organization will thrive when it's participatory and as opposed to sort of authoritative. And that's the way that I approach my work. Yeah.
Connecting.
Yes. Was that it? Okay. Yes, in the back. Thank you for the question.
Did people hear the question?
The question is what do I feel that the regents have done best or well that I'm most proud of? No, you know, so I think we've done a lot of really extraordinary things. In my first term, and it really goes to this question of, you know, what is the purpose of the University of California and how do we approach what we do here? And so you all know the three tenets of access, affordability, and quality. And after 209, there were real issues around access. And we actually established a task force on enrollment and admissions. Jenny, I think you were there at the time.
Yes.
My gosh, you staffed us all the way back then. But we did. We established a task force on enrollment and admissions. We really tried to figure it out. You know, we went to comprehensive review. We really tried to identify the potential of students as opposed to just depending on GPA and SAT. We actually minimized the over-reliance on SAT. So I think there were a lot of really important things that we've done around ensuring that, you know, we're still a university for all Californians. I'm very proud of that work.
what we're doing today. And this is really led by Janet and her commitment around access. You know, the work that we're doing on transiting Steve here, the work that we're doing on transfers. And, you know, I went to community college. I understand the role that community colleges play. And so, you know, for lots of the, you know, people in my community and others, you know, working, there's just lots of reasons why community colleges are so important, and they very often are the first stepping stone into higher ed. But how do we actually then move you into a four-year, you know, university experience and get you graduated into the workforce? So I think all of the work that we're doing around access is really important. And you know, so it's initiated very often out of the university, you know, OP, or it's initiated because of conversations with external stakeholders. But the regents are the ones that adopt those policies. You know, they set those policies, and then, you know, the university has the drive to accomplish them. So as a policy-making body, you know, I'm really proud of that. And, you know, opening a 10th campus, that happened, you know. So I think there's really important work going on, and we can't forget it. You know, every day, you know, there's students walking through our doors getting UC quality education. And that makes me really proud to have been a part of this system that has been able to maintain all of that, you know, through the ups and downs of an economy. The hardest time was in, you know, the financial downturn. And I was chair of the finance committee and was, you know, it was tough. It was really tough because we didn't have revenue sources, so we had to turn to tuition. And we all know what that has meant. And so, sure, you backfill with financial aid and that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, it's uneven. There's things that I wish we could have turned the clock back on, but at the time they were the best decisions for the university. We lost $1 billion, and that was just a really hard period of time. So, you know, I guess another way to answer the question is, do you exercise your best judgment when you're making decisions? It may not be perfect. You may not satisfy everybody, but if you're true to yourself and you can wake up and say, you know what, I used my best judgment and, you know, that was my guidepost, and, you know, certainly you evaluate all of the data. But so there's things I'm proud of and things that, or, you know, which is hard decisions that you have to make along the way. Yes?
As you're evaluating your next steps, and given what we're facing nationwide right now, is more involved political office on the table for you?
Yeah, the question was, am I suicidal? joking. The question was, is political office something that I would consider, which is synonymous with political office? No. And you know why? Because I think the I've thought about it, you know. There's no doubt about it. I've been asked. I've thought about it. Because it goes to the question of why would you want to be a regent? Because you get to influence the system, you know. So here's a policy-making body, whether it's local government or something else. But all of the things that come with that, being political players in the public sphere, having to raise money, you know, it goes also to the question of just independent judgment. You know, I want to know that I'm not being asked to do things on behalf of people that may have supported me that wouldn't be consistent with what I wanted to do. And that was the beauty of working in a newspaper, is that you weren't beholden to anybody. You know, you don't contribute, you don't do, you know, you're every day you're thinking about, you know, a way to navigate where the only question in your mind is, does what the position of that individual serve the best interests of my community? And so I'm not interested in elected office. I think there's other ways to serve and to be involved with policymaking. But thank you for the question.
Maybe
one or two more
questions.
Yes, back there. I don't know who raised your hand. Yes.
Yeah. So, Monica, from a woman's perspective, if you had shown your question when you said earlier you did this. Would it, do you think it would have changed your path?
That's a great question. If I had shown my emotions, would it have changed my path? I think probably, yeah. You know, I'm not a student of this. It's not like I, you know a lot about sort of organizational behavior, but just on what I've observed, I do think women that, you know, show or demonstrate lots of emotion, and I don't mean emotion, like, you know, joy and, you know, passion, that sort of thing, but just emotionally react to things. Yeah, I think there's sort of a stereotype still. There's a question about, you know, your judgment or do you really have what it takes to rise up the ranks and that sort of thing. Yeah, well, I worked with, it was a family business, so if you have siblings, that's a pretty emotional. And when my brother was the publisher, and I was like, it's funny, I know we're going to run out of time, but we brought in a consultant 10 years, like I was working there for 10 years, and our company was growing so fast that we needed like an organizational management consultant to come in and help us sort of navigate growth. And they came in and they, you know, interviewed everybody and they looked at, you know, sort of the business plan and our strategy, and they said, you know, she's really good where she is, but she would be better for the organization if you moved her into the publisher's office. And my brother didn't take that very well. And so, you know, we had to navigate all of that. And there were times in our, so we would have executive committee meetings every week, kind of a cabinet meeting. And, you know, he'd be down there and I'd be over there and people would just be doing this. And I think it's only because it was a family-owned business that it was allowed to have that kind of emotion, you know, and people knew that I was on a path. But I think in most organizations that are highly bureaucratic or that have, you know, a career tracking, you know, you're going to go from this and you're going to do that and we'll have you do this for a few years, it's very complicated. And they're going to expect more and more from you. And so I do think you have to keep your emotions in check. It's probably somewhat unfortunate, might be changing now. But that's a great question.
One last question?
Yeah, so you've talked a lot about serving the Latino community, mm-hmm. but there's so many different divergent point of views and needs, you know, within the Latino community, right. And you were able to serve that community
yeah.
over decades and decades. So how did you find those commonalities to draw, you know, such a large and divergent audience to your paper? And what do you think that means for kind of media today in serving the Latino community today, given our current context?
So the question was, you know, the Latino community isn't homogenous, very divergent, you know, points of view. How do you navigate that in my work? And then, you know, sort of lessons for media today, given the political environment. And so when we thought about commonality, it was really around issues. And so there's just some fundamental issues where there's just, you know, the data points to it, right? And I mentioned some of those. So those were the things that really became our guideposts, right? You know, if the data says that there's 3 million Hispanics that are eligible to become citizens and yet have not done so, well, you know what? Let's help them figure out, you know, what are the steps that they need to take. So we always focused on issues that were, you know, more common. And I do want to say this. It's not just Latinos. And this was something I really worked hard at. We were in Spanish, but I think of us as being part of a broader ecosystem that is every day more multicultural, more multigenerational, multilingual. And so we needed to cross bridges, not just within the community, but to outside that community. And so focusing on the things that we had in common, you know, with African Americans, with the API community, with, you know, gay, lesbian community. So we always looked that was our focus. It was really about an issues orientation as opposed to like a political or an ideological orientation. At the end of the day, people would say, I think that we were fairly progressive in our point of view, but, and then I think, you know, today, you know, I'm worried about media that is so fractured and that is so personally curated towards one's own point of view, and the ability to you know, live in a world where you're not exposed to other ideas and you don't participate in a broader conversation, I don't think it's good for democracy. I don't think it's good for our country. And yet this customization of content is just, you know, what happens. So we've got to figure out a way in which we can, you know, create networks, you know, lattice it together in a way that people do get exposed to different points of view. It's really clear right now that the schisms that we're seeing in many ways were contributed to by that kind of fractured information space that we're in today. Anyway, I think we're...